pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Our guest today is the inspirational Sanjay Deshpande, who was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor at the age of 29. A massive grand mal seizure landed him in the emergency room on the day he landed on the Harvard University campus to start his master's program in September 2021. The same week, he flew back to India to get a 7-hour-long brain surgery. It's been almost 2 years since, and he's tumor-free. He's passionate about mental health, queer rights, and cancer advocacy. He loves to dance and has recently started writing poetry. He hopes to publish a memoir someday and travel the world before he kicks the bucket, he says. He led the effort to conceptualize, manage, write, and publish his first book, Don't Ask Me How I'm Doing, with several other contributors to raise awareness about the unique challenges faced by South Asian and Indian young adult cancer patients, survivors, and caregivers. He hopes this book will help hundreds, if not thousands, of others who have to deal with an insidious disease like cancer when they are at the peak of their lives and careers. He is back to Harvard now to finish his master's program, surprising everyone around him, including his doctor. Listen in as Sanjay shares his journey with all honesty in this conversation, completely vulnerable and pragmatic. Hi, Sanjay. Such a pleasure to meet you after conversations on LinkedIn. Welcome to You and I with Rashmi Shetty.
Thank you so much for having me over. I'm very excited.
So am I. But before we get to the Sanjay Deshpande that the world knows you today as, I want to know what little Sanjay was like. What kind of a boy were you in school, college? What was your childhood like and where was it?
That's a very interesting question. I grew up across different parts of the world, technically. I was born in a place called Nanded in Maharashtra. And then I grew up in a place called Riyadh, which is the capital of Saudi Arabia. And then I came back to Hyderabad, which is where my parents currently live. And I spent a large part of my childhood in these three places. And then I went to Delhi, Bombay, and then now in Cambridge, Boston for my work and education. Yeah, so I had a pretty normal childhood as a kid. I was quite mischievous and my parents would constantly run around or run behind me to make sure that I don't do something naughty again. And since I grew up in different parts of the country and the world, I had a very multicultural sort of like a childhood. My parents are half Marathi, half Telugu. And on my mother's side, she's half Marathi, half Kannada. And my father's side is half Marathi, half Telugu. So I grew up in a multicultural household, speaking multiple languages and learning multiple cultures. So it was very interesting for me to only realize later on that, you know, I have a very like different sort of an upbringing from, say, my classmates and friends that I had at that time. This helped me see the world in multiple dimensions instead of looking at it in a single dimension. It was less 2D for me and more 4D for me. Yeah, I think right about around my 8th grade is when I started taking my academics seriously. Till then, I was barely interested in studying.
Were you into sports or something at that point of time?
I was actually into dance. So I would spend a
Oh.
lot of time in dance. I would spend a lot of time playing with my friends. I used to love playing outdoors, like the regular games, like hide and seek and stuff like that. I think something switched in me in my 8th grade. I think it could be because I had a very good teacher, class teacher, who made me realize that studying would give me studying well would give me the opportunities I want in my life to succeed. And that kind of flipped my entire approach to school then. I mean, even before that, I was always getting trophies and medals home for extracurricular activities like dance, like debates, and for like Model United Nations, but not necessarily was I wasn't necessarily in the top of my class till 8th standard. But then that switched in 8th standard. And then I was always in top three. Like, come hail or high water, I would do anything to make sure I was in top three because I also started enjoying studying. I think it gave me a sense of adrenaline rush to be able to solve a certain math problem, to be able to do a certain essay well. And I had really good teachers who encouraged me, who helped me learn. Instead of just like mugging up and like vomiting it on exam papers. So that really changed my educational trajectory. This helped me get really good grades in my 10th standard exam. And my parents' first instinct, my parents are both doctors, and I have an older sister who's an engineer, and all my cousins in my family are engineers. And my parents' first instinct was to put me in medical preparatory program like biology, physics, chemistry, plus 12 program or 12 standard program. But then I was scared of blood. So I was just like, I am not going to be a doctor at any cost. And I'd seen my mother work really hard. She's a surgeon and she would have to spend like nights in the hospital and she was at the beck and call of her patients. I did not want that life for myself. Both my parents spent nearly 11 years to just finish studying to start earning. And I did not want that for myself at all. So I decided to do maths, physics, chemistry because that was the only other option I was aware of. Because, in Hyderabad, at least you're either a doctor or an engineer. No other option per se exists. So I started doing maths, physics, chemistry as my 11th and 12th standard courses, but my parents also put me in IIT JEE prep, which is like a rite of passage or almost like a ritual that every person goes through in the South. But I think midway in my first year, I realized that I did not want to be an engineer because there was a part of me that was like crying from inside every time I was like, just focusing on these subjects because I felt like there was a part of me that wanted to do other things like art, social sciences, humanities, but those
Could you
options were.
dance? Your dance took a backseat.
Yeah, that too. Like, I actually did not get an opportunity to pursue that as a career. Although my mother and father never really stopped me from exploring that, they never saw it as a career. That's the only difference. But as hobbies, they never discouraged me. Then I rebelled at one point. I was just like, no, I'm not going to do engineering. And my parents were like, we are going to make you an engineer. There's no other option. So I ran away from home. And I ran away from home, yes, because they were very persistent. And I was just like, okay, if it's not going to be my way, then I'll have to do something extreme to help you understand that I'm not going to pursue this. So I ran away from home. I went to my grandmother's place and then they did not know where I was for a long time and they freaked out. And then later they found out I was at my grandmother's place. And then I think a bunch of people in my family helped them understand it. First, they tried to convince me and I was just like, I steadfastly said no. And that's when they realized, okay, let him do what he wants to do. So I dropped out of the IIT JEE prep and I continued to finish my 12th standard.
With the
And
maths and science.
yes, maths and science.
Okay.
The unfortunate or fortunate thing was I did extremely well in maths and science, and my parents again freaked out. They're like, you have 100% score in your maths and you have an aggregate score of 98% in maths and science. Why would you not do engineering? And I'm just like, just because I'm good at something doesn't mean I'm interested in it. That was an uphill battle to fight with them, to help them understand that, I genuinely don't want to pursue this. And at that point, they asked me, okay, what do you want to pursue? There were very few, I mean, there were very limited opportunities for me to understand what exists out there. One of the things that I found interesting at that point was becoming a news anchor. I wanted to be like a Rajdeep Sardesai. I wanted to be like a Barkhadat on screen, doing like international reporting and like being in the Kargil war and like reporting from there. So I told them I want to be a journalist. And they were like, is that even a career option? And then I applied to a bunch of schools across the country. I think I applied to Manipal University, I applied to Symbiosis Pune, and I applied to several colleges in Bombay. But we had no idea which ones were good, which ones were not, because these were not things anyone in my family had pursued. So I eventually got through Xavier's Bombay, and like I had an uncle who used to live in Bombay who told us that, the stalwarts of like business world, finance world, and Bollywood go to Xavier's Bombay. It's the best college in the West. I mean, it's one of the best colleges in the country. And we were like, what is this college? We have no idea. We've never heard of it. So then, once he convinced me and my parents, rather my parents and I, then I decided to be at Xavier's Bombay. And that was quite an experience. I think Xavier's Bombay opened the world to me.
And
Spending
you
time
did
in
journalism, is it, in Xavier?
Yes, I studied media and communication. The two subjects that were majors were journalism and advertising.
Okay. And which
So,
year are we in now,
2010.
chronologically? Okay.
2010, that's when I joined Xavier's Bombay. At Xavier's Bombay, I mean, there were two large things that happened at Xavier's Bombay. One, I got bullied to a certain extent. I felt out of place to a large extent, because my cultural and social class was very different. I did not speak English as well as them. I did not have the same social currency as them. I did not have the exposure they had. So it felt like I was completely out of place. I felt like a fish that has been like pulled out of water and put on a plate. But at the same time, I also got a lot of exposure, which I otherwise would have never got. And through that process, I learned a lot about the world. I learned a lot about myself. I learned about what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. And by the time I graduated from Xavier's Bombay, I was the student of the year and valedictorian. So I was pretty happy to have had that exposure.
What helped you, Sanjay, looking back now, if you felt like a fish out of water, what is it that kept you motivated and pushed you to end up as the best student?
I think I had great friends. I mean, it was very annoying that they would correct my English all the time, but then that helped me learn the language better. The way I speak now, I think in a large part is due to their credit. I mean, the credit goes to them. If they hadn't corrected me the umpteen numbers of time they did, I would not be speaking the way I do. I would not have been able to write a book. I would never be an author. So that's number one.
But you
Number.
were somebody who was a debater, a person who
Yeah, but then
argued.
I think the standards are very different in the South versus the standards being in Bombay. I think the way you speak a certain language, an accent, the kind of words you use, they're very different. That was a big cultural shock for me, because I think in South we don't care so much about like how flowery our vocabulary is, how many different ways can you say the same thing? But when I reached Bombay, I was surrounded by people who went to really, really good schools. So I had batchmates who went to Dhirubhai Ambani School. I had batchmates who went to international schools. I had batchmates who were from American Embassy School. I had batchmates from the Doon School, Mayo College School. And that made me realize that, studying in ICSE, IISc, and international boards, and in general, like IB programs and Cambridge programs, gives you a rich vocabulary and like a very strong hold of English as a language, instead of just like having the rudimentary sort of like basic skeleton of the language through which you communicate. I mean, which I was pretty good at. I had the basic skeleton, but I didn't have the polish, so to speak. The gravitas and the panache and the polish comes with a different kind of exposure and practice, which I built at Xavier's.
So then you went on to complete it. You finished college with top honors. Then
Yeah.
where did life take you?
Life gave me a huge shock. I thought like right after graduating as the best student at Xavier's, I would like the world would open its doors for me and there would be like opportunities over opportunities, but there weren't that many opportunities. And so I faced my first setback by realizing that the world I had chosen to be a part of, which is media and communication, was very cutthroat and like very competitive. So my first job, I earned 16,000 rupees a month, which wasn't enough to survive in a place like Bombay, where like real estate is so expensive. Rent in itself is so high that some days I would not be even able to afford food. I had to borrow money from my parents, which felt extremely, extremely shameful. Because here I was, who had fought with my parents and said, like, oh, I'm going to become a journalist now. I'm going to become an advertiser now. And I'm going to become like a big shot. You just wait and see how like the world is going to bow to me. And here I am begging them for money again. So that was a very huge shock for me. But it also made me realize that academics are very different from what the real world is like. You could be fantastic at something academically, and the real world looks for different things and works very differently. There's a hidden curriculum. Just because you're the best student at something doesn't necessarily mean you get best opportunities. Your network matters, who you know matters, because that actually gets you jobs, that actually gets you promotions. And navigating how the workplace works, how the politics work, all of those are things that I had to learn on my own. And if only I had a mentor or a advisor who could teach me these things, then I would have been far more successful at that point of time. I learned all of it, but it was through a lot of, how do I put it, through a lot of speed bumps, speed breakers, and like hitting the wall multiple times. So yeah, so I started my career with like a very, very, very rudimentary salary. And then I discovered this program called the Young India Fellowship Program at Ashoka University, which was called the Rhodes Scholarship of India. So I was extremely interested because I had started working in advertising instead of journalism for about like 6 to 8 months when I realized that I don't want to be selling fairness creams to people who are already beautiful. It felt very unethical to me to do a lot of stuff that advertising requires you to do. So it didn't align with my personal values. And then like I had an existential crisis that I spent 3 years learning this and I'm not even sure I want to do this anymore. So in that existential crisis, I decided to do the Young India Fellowship Program. Again, a very competitive program. Very few people get through it. Has an acceptance rate of less than 10%. I still decided to go ahead and apply.
No, one
And
second. Never did you think of going back to Hyderabad to be with your parents and try in Hyderabad?
no, I wanted to be as far away from home as possible because there are a couple of interesting things. I felt like they were stuck in the past. They were stuck in their own time, and I had progressed a lot because they did not have the exposure I had. Bombay gave me a lot of exposure. Bombay gave me a lot of access to experiences and access to networks, which they did not have. So they did not understand my life, my aspirations, the lifestyle I lived. So in many ways, like going back felt like I was being stifled. Apart from visiting my parents like a couple of times a year, and speaking to them like a couple of times a week, I didn't necessarily want to go back to Hyderabad or go back to living with my parents. So I got into the Young India Fellowship program. That was quite the life-changing experience again. I would have never found out about Young India Fellowship program if I had not gone to Xavier's Bombay. So this helped me understand how cultural capital works. It's a currency that you have, which is invisible in nature, but is only available to people who have earned it, or like who have the resources for it. So it's a privilege in many ways. So I went to a Young India Fellowship program. It's a 1-year liberal arts and leadership program taught by professors from across the world, from the best universities, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Yale. So I got exposed to a sort of curriculum that I had never experienced before. So in India, our education system is modeled on the way Oxford and Cambridge work. We have 3-year undergraduate programs. You pick a subject and you go deep into it, and that's how it works. And it's a lecture format. Like there's a teacher who imparts knowledge to students, and students are expected to give exams at the end of the year to learn, to prove that they have mastered the knowledge that they have been imparted with. And I went to Young India Fellowship program, which is based on the American system of education, which is a lot of dialogue, the Socratic method of learning, a lot of discussion, a lot of, reading and like self-learning and self-directed learning. You could choose what you want to study, which for me was mind-blowing. So I became a huge fan of liberal arts immediately. And I decided that I want to switch into the education sector, because I feel like that's my calling. I want to help others get access to the kind of education I got access to, because of which I am the person I am today. And that's how I switched into education. While I was at the fellowship, I did a I worked with the University of Chicago's International Innovation Corps, which is their sort of a fellowship program in India, where they pick a bunch of students to work with a member of the parliament to help them in their own projects. So I got a chance to work with the member of parliament from Jaipur, Colonel Rajyavardhan Singh Rathod, who is an Olympian. And the project we worked on was called Pradhan Mantri Model Village Project, the PM Model Village Project, where like each MP adopts a village and transforms it into a model village, and that will be then replicated across their state.
So did you choose your MP or you were allotted the MP?
No, I was allotted an MP. I think back then I did not know enough about Indian politics to necessarily make any decisions per se. I am far more aware now. Luckily for me, I had a bunch of friends who studied at very good universities with like a lot more political awareness. Like I had friends from JNU, Delhi University, Jamia, when I was living in Delhi, who helped
Oh,
me
so the
understand.
scholarship took you to Delhi. The
Yeah,
scholarship
the Young India
took
Fellowship
you to Delhi.
Program. Yeah, the Ashoka University is in Sonipat, which is a part of Delhi NCR. So I then moved to Delhi and I started living in Delhi. I lived in Delhi for about 7 years in total, after 4 years in Bombay. So I moved there. That was an amazing experience because I got exposure again to different style of education, different subjects that I never thought of, different professors who taught in different pedagogies, and it was really mind-blowing. So then I shifted into education, and then I started my first job after the Young India Fellowship program was in this startup called Purple Squirrel EduVentures, which worked on helping students do an apprenticeship, or what is traditionally called industry visits, so that they understand like what a day in the life of a certain professional is. Because the big problem in India is students are made to choose careers without knowing what that career entails. And so we thought, at least the company thought, that if students had the ability to see what a day in the life of a certain professional is, then they would be able to make better decisions about their careers. So yeah, I worked there for 6 months. Unfortunately, because it was a startup, it shut down. And then I had to look for another job. And then I moved into the nonprofit space because I was like, I want to do something which involves social impact. I don't want to do any for-profit work at this moment. So I moved into the nonprofit space. I worked with NASSCOM's foundation. NASSCOM is the industry body for all the IT and BPO companies in India. And that was again a brilliant experience because I was able to build a lot of skills that I did not have in project management, in community outreach, in program management, in stakeholder management, in negotiation, conflict management, everything. I think my stint at NASSCOM Foundation, which was for 2 years, really helped me become the person I am today. And I had brilliant mentors, amazing managers, and a very, very congenial work culture, which helped me grow as a person. And from being a young headless chicken, I went on to become someone who ran a multi-million dollar project for across the country. That really helped me see how social impact works. But then I was largely doing managing or monitoring programs. I was like, I want to get my hands dirty. I want to build something from scratch. So then Pramath Sinha, who is the founding dean of ISB Hyderabad and founder of Ashoka University, who was the person who actually interviewed me for a Young India Fellowship, was looking for people to join his team, which was going to start something new in the space of 21st century skills for adult learners. And they were looking for people back then. I applied and then I joined them as their first founding team members. And then for the next 3.5 years, I spent building Harappa from scratch. Again, that was a life-changing experience because I saw how organizations are built from scratch. I saw what it takes to move an idea from a brainstorming stage to a minimum viable product stage to a pilot stage to the iteration stage to rollout stage, and then taking feedback and pivoting when required. And we had to pivot because COVID happened in between, and then we had to change our delivery model. We had to change the way we made revenue, and all of that was quite a big learning experience. I got to mentor a lot of reportees, move from an individual team member to a manager, manager to a senior manager, senior manager to a senior manager to a vertical lead. So I had a lot of professional growth in the 3.5 years that I was at Harappa. And my managers were very good in helping me grow. They pushed me to build my own managerial skills. And I had great colleagues who gave me support to be a better leader. And I had great reportees who helped me become a better manager. Yeah, I still look back very fondly at the team I worked with at Harappa.
Yeah, I can see that. At this point, when you've been telling us about your life and your entire journey, was there a point when you paused and said, "Oh my God, life, thank you so much for making me the chosen one"? Because you seem to be in the right place at the right time, picking the right skills, equipping yourself for the next step life had planned for you.
Actually, it was the other way around. I burnt out multiple times in my journey. And
Oh.
because I was so ambitious and because I was all about like, oh, I want to be successful. I want to go to Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Yale. I pushed myself very hard in terms of achievement. And my orientation was towards like the next goal always. So never being satisfied with having enough.
Okay.
So I pushed myself very hard, and that pushing myself very hard led to a lot of success. But it came always at a cost. So I would either have physical exhaustion or mental burnout multiple times. I mean, they were peppered throughout my career. But finally, in the pandemic, I think I had a big mental breakdown, which made me completely depressed and suicidal because I felt like no matter what I did was never enough, which is when I started seeking therapy. I know it's a big taboo word in the professional world. In general, in India, therapy is just like
Not
very.
anymore. I think the pandemic has shaken everyone today.
I hope so. I hope so, because I talk very openly about mental health and like the importance of taking care of your mental health. And my therapist really helped me overcome a lot of these challenges I was facing. That helped me survive whatever I was going through. The every time I had a mental breakdown, I knew that I had a therapist that I could go to figure out how to navigate it. I
Okay.
was at the right place at the right time, but I also pushed myself to the brink of exhaustion and burnout, and that kind of made me only realize in retrospect when I got diagnosed with cancer that my lifestyle was pretty bad. I was working for long hours, sometimes 14 hours a day, barely sleeping enough, not eating on time, not getting enough exercise, just because I was just so focused on doing well at work. And working in a startup and working in nonprofits is not easy. There's sometimes just a lot to do, and there are not enough people. And you have targets to achieve, and then there are people dependent on you. And you keep telling yourself that, you know, you'll start the gym later, you will start exercising later, or you can eat dinner later, or you can sleep over the weekend, but then you're working on weekends as well. So that kind of affected my health a lot. So I would not say that I ever paused to reflect and feel grateful about my journey. Although I would say that I feel extremely grateful that even though I never acknowledge it openly, I was lucky enough that my parents relented and let me pursue these educational experiences, even though they had no clue about them, did not understand how it works, and let me pursue my own career. They did not put any pressure on me. I mean, of course, my mother would call once in a while and say, like, oh, look at that cousin who's earning so much. He's now working at Google. Or look at that cousin. He has moved to the US now. See, if you had done engineering, you would have also become like this. I mean, I think she was just trying to encourage me in a very roundabout way. But yeah, I think I'm just grateful that I got the opportunities I got. Especially educational opportunities, because I realize how the pedigree of your college and the network that you get from your college really propels you in your career. Yes, in the first few years it matters the most, but later in your career also, you don't look for jobs or get jobs through job portal websites. You essentially get them through your network. So that's what I discovered and learned. And yeah, I'm grateful for that.
So all your moves, you just shared how you had a burnout each time, but that burnout was never part of your story while you were sharing it. So the shifts were because of the burnout, or the shifts were because you read something, saw something, and you were like, okay, this is the next best thing. So let me jump onto that bandwagon. Every time you moved to a different space, was it because you read about it and thought, okay, this is where I should be? What drew you to the different spaces? You said, now I need to get my hands dirty, and then you went into that space. So what was propelling you? What was it that was telling you, Sanjay, okay, now move? What did you want?
I think they were not always motivated by burnout. Sometimes they were motivated by burnout in the organization I was working with, but a lot of the times they were motivated by this fire in my belly, which wanted to like try new things. And but I did not want to leave the sector completely. I started with a public education for school students to skilling and training. And then I moved to using technology for training. Then I moved into online learning. Two things motivated me. One is the need to see impact, because I like tangible impact. I like to be able to say that so many people benefited from this program that I created or I designed or I was a part of. But I think the other thing that motivated me was also the fact that I felt the need to try different things. Because if this was the nonprofit way of doing it, I want to see what the for-profit way to do it. I want to see what the social enterprise model is. I want to see how technology for good works. So there was this need to try new things. I couldn't stay in one place for too long, because there was this insatiable desire to learn new ways of doing the same thing.
So the Sanjay who woke up in eighth standard was the one that propelled you
Yeah,
to
maybe.
do everything that you were doing then on?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, there was that. Yeah, I think I just wanted to try different things and learn different ways of scaling impact.
Okay, as a result of all of this, when were you diagnosed with cancer and where were you at that?
There's a bit of a backstory for that. While I was working at Harappa, a year and a half before I moved on from there, I applied to a lot of colleges in the UK. I wanted to study how there could be alternate ways of being a leader, because every time someone thinks of leadership, there's a very
Finite
image of it, right? Like there's a very stoic person who is like really driving the organization, is no nonsense, takes their job seriously. But I felt like there could be alternate ways of being a leader. I think right around that time, Jacinda, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, did a fabulous job of handling the pandemic. And I thought like that way of being an empathetic, a more authentic leader who's willing to talk about their emotions, their challenges out in the open and not consider that as a weakness, was a very fascinating thing to study and to promote in organizations. So I had applied for organizational behavior, organizational psychology programs in the UK. I was going to go to London School of Economics to do my master's, but the pandemic hit, and then my parents and my mentor both told me that, I should probably skip it for now. So I skipped that, and then I continued working at Harappa for 1.5 years. And then I applied to Harvard, and I got through Harvard, and I moved on from Harappa to go to Harvard. I landed at Harvard University. On the day I landed on campus, I got a life-threatening seizure. I was taken to the ER. I was in the ER for 48 hours. And 48 hours later, they did MRI scans and CT scans and told me they found something in my head. They sat down next to me and, in a very nonchalant way, told me that you seem to have a malignant brain tumor. And our assumption is if that's true, then you may not live for more than 5 years. This was on the day before my orientation for a program that I had looked forward to for so long. And so that's when I got diagnosed, and I was still in a daze, but I still managed to call up my sister, tell her to inform my parents, because I did not have the heart to tell my parents. My parents then found out. They, of course, had a huge like shock, but then my father was strong enough to speak to the doctor. The doctors in the US were trying to wheel me into the emergency surgery room because they were like, we need to get this tumor out immediately, otherwise you're not going to live. And I in no way wanted to get treated in the US because medical insurance is very infamous in the US, and my parents are both doctors. It would be much easier for me to be back in Hyderabad and get treatment done. So I came back to India. I mean, so the doc, so my father spoke to the surgeon there, and he convinced the surgeon that I'll get my treatment done in India immediately and I should be discharged. The doctors in the Harvard Medical School Hospital reluctantly discharged me, making me sign a legal document saying that we have discharged you against medical advice, and anything that happens to you is not our responsibility. And then I had to take a 30-hour flight back to India. And then we met several
And
doctors.
you traveled alone
Yeah, I mean, there was no other option for me because,
yeah. And what was do you recall what was what were the stream of consciousness spaces that you were in while you were traveling back? Any thoughts, anything that you recall?
all I kept thinking of, which I remember, is like, do not get a seizure in the plane. I'll be deboarded. Do not get a seizure. Do not get a seizure. I just kept telling myself for 30 hours, do not get a seizure. And that's all I could think of. I think it hadn't hit me that, someone had told me that you have only 5 years left to live, because I was just so focused on like the next step. I went to the college. I got myself a deferral. I did everything here. I got my fees refunded. I got my dorm fees or hostel fees refunded. I did all of that, and then I left. So I was almost in this mechanical mode where I completely blocked out what had happened and what I was informed, and was just focusing on, okay, this needs to be done, this needs to be done, this needs to be done. And I boarded the flight, and then I started thinking, okay.
It's like so logical thinking. Which part of you made you do all of this? Because even if you're an autopilot, to know that, okay, I need to go back, it may take some time back in India, so I need to do all these financials, is something where you have to be super alert to remember, right? Because you're all alone there.
Yeah, I think there's a part of my brain that just kicked in saying that, okay, Sanjay, this has happened. You cannot change it. So what can you do right now? I'm a very pragmatic person, even with my diagnosis and prognosis. I know that it's incurable cancer. I know it'll come back. I know it'll eventually kill me. But can I live my life till that happens? So what can I do right now to live well till that happens? So how can I adapt my life to make sure that I have good quality of life till I eventually die? I'm very pragmatic in that way. Like, people look at me and think like, what a weird person is this? Like, why are they not like feeling very emotional about it? Oh, I'm very emotional about it. I feel like, yes, there are days when I feel like, oh my God, why this has happened to me? What was my fault and all of that? And then there are days when I'm just like, this has happened. Now, what do you do about it? What is within the realm of your control and what is not in the realm of your control? So if there are things which are within the realm of your control, what can you do about them? So I've changed my lifestyle. I sleep on time. I eat better. I try to get some exercise. I make sure I avoid my seizure triggers. I take my medication on time. I meet my doctors regularly. So that's all I can control. Now, when will this come back? Well, God knows when it'll come back. So I can't really do much about it. So my parents really hated that I'm so pragmatic, because they're like, either I think people in general are scared of mortality. There's death anxiety in our society in general. But I'm not scared of dying anymore, because that'll just make me dysfunctional. I will not be able to do anything if I'm constantly thinking about, oh my God, I'm going to die. So what I'm scared of, though, is dying a very painful death, or dying or living a life which doesn't have good quality of life. I'd rather die early than live a life which is painful, or which is like completely dysfunctional.
Because those who are born are going to die one day. So
Yeah, everyone's
many of
going
us
to die.
don't know when, and
Yeah.
that's how we live, like we're going to live forever. But
Yeah, I'm at least aware of my mortality. I am aware of the fact that, there's this bubble of invincibility that you have, especially as a young person. I got diagnosed at 29. I mean, who would have imagined, like, at 29, you
and
would
this
come
was
face to face?
post-pandemic or in the
This
pandemic?
was post-pandemic, September 2021.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I came face to face with mortality. I had a near-death experience, and that kind of pops the bubble and makes you realize that you're not invincible. And like, you keep thinking and pushing things to the future, thinking that, oh, I'm gonna live till 50, I'm gonna live till 60, I'm gonna live till 80, 90. But what if you don't? And so how can you live right now? What do you need to do right now to make the most of the time you have?
True. So, what did you do once you came back to India?
Came back, met a lot of doctors, scoped out the best hospitals we could go to, and then we decided on our surgery date, because my parents did not want me to get any surgical intervention. They were hoping, like, if I could just get chemo or radiation and it'll get better. But the doctor said, like, till we do a surgery and see what type of cancer it is, we can't necessarily decide what the treatment will be. So then we had to set a date for surgery, and I got operated on 28 September 2021. It was a 7.5 hour long surgery, and it was really life threatening, because brain is a very vital organ. Like, if even if you touch something inadvertently, a person could either be paralyzed or dead or lose their ability to speak, move. So many things that can go wrong. And fortunately for me, my surgeon was excellent. And in that way, my surgery went well. But I think I had partial paralysis on the left side of my body because of the surgery. I mean, which we knew, like, because my tumor was in the right part of my brain, that there would be some sort of an after effect of my surgery. So I spent then after that a couple of months learning how to use the left side of my body again. I literally had to learn how to pick up stuff from my left side, had using my left hand. I had to learn how to, like, feed myself. I had to learn how to clothe myself, bathe myself. It was very difficult, the rehabilitation period, but then I had no choice, so I pushed myself to do it because I was like, I'm not going to live like this. I have to push myself. I still have deficits, which are cognitive. Like, the left side of my body is still not at 100%. It's at 90%, so which is a physical deficit, but I don't let it affect my life. I find ways to make sure that I compensate for it. I have cognitive deficits. I mean, my memory, focus, and attention is not 100%. And any kind of physical strain or mental stress triggers seizures for me. So I have to be constantly vigilant. Not eating on time gets me a seizure. Not sleeping well gives me a seizure. Everything a 30-year-old, a young 30-year-old would do ends up giving me a seizure. So I can't drink alcohol. I can't even go near alcohol. Yeah, like, a lot of my lifestyle habits have changed significantly. Even my own understanding of life in general changed significantly because of what I've gone through. The surgery happened. I spent about 3, 4 months rehabilitating. And then I was trying to look for another person who's a young adult with cancer, and I couldn't find a single person because most cancer support groups or cancer support resources in India or in general in the world have either lots of cancer patients are either geriatric patients, which are like people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, or pediatric patients, people who are under the age of 16. So I couldn't find a person who's of my age who I could discuss my challenges with. I had very specific challenges. I couldn't figure out, how do I go back to living life? How do I go back to work? Should I go back to studying? How do I tell people what I've been through? How do I socialize again with friends? How do I figure out whether or not I want to settle down? How do I look for a partner? How do I marry someone? How do I tell them the fact that we perhaps may not have children, or like it may not be a great idea to have children? So a lot of those things are very unique to people with who lie in the 17 to 39 year age group, which is called the young adult age group, because you're at the pivotal point of your life where you're like, you're at the peak of your career, peak of your personal life, and you suddenly hit with like a wall of bricks. Yeah, I think it's a miracle that I'm still in the shape and form that I'm in, and I'm studying at Harvard University. It's ridiculous. My doctor's like, how the hell are you doing this? It's a miracle. Because my cancer is also one in a million. Like, literally less than 1% people get it. And they certainly don't get it at the age that I got it. So my case was clinically very unique. And my recovery also has been clinically very unique because it's been well enough for me to get back to a rigorous master's program at Harvard University. But at the same time, I do still get seizures here. They're not as bad as they were earlier, but I still get them because it's a lot of stress. It's a lot of mental strain. Yeah, so I couldn't find anyone, and I tried looking for resources for people like me to answer the questions I had. Couldn't find anything in India, couldn't find anything in South Asia in general. Found some in the West, in the UK and the US, but they were not culturally aligned to what we are used to. So I was like, hey, there's nothing that's here for people like us. I think someone needs to create that resource. So that's how I decided to write my book. So the book is on adulting with cancer, with stories from people from Indian diaspora who exactly dealt with these issues.
And what did the journey teach you, Sanjay?
Oh, the journey taught me so much. Like, one of my co-authors for the book has passed away already. And she had stage 4 breast cancer, and she had been through so many treatments, so many rounds of chemo, so many alternate therapies. And We had just gone to a literature festival because we were invited, and we spoke right after Ruskin Bond spoke, and we were so happy. We were so excited to be these authors who've been called to a literature festival. First time authors, that too. But I think a couple of months after that, she passed away, and it was the rudest shock of my life that, someone could look so normal and still be going through hell and not show it on their faces at all. It made me realize how my cancer experience is very unique. And if anything at all, I'm the one of the lucky people. Although it's not an Olympics, we are not comparing like who's better at this and who's worse at it. But the journey to write the book was also very interesting because I had a huge imposter syndrome about my communication skills, thanks to the number of times I had been corrected in college. So I did not think I was good enough to speak, let alone write English. So it took a lot of courage, it took a lot of motivation, it took a lot of cheerleading from my friends to push me to get this done. But then I genuinely wanted to do something to give back to the community now I belong to. I had no option but to do something because I felt like I'm going to go mad if there are no resources. And I thought that after me, at least someone else will have the resource. And it's not a book, it's not a self-help book, it's not a book that's giving you any advice. It's just an anthology of stories of people who are struggling in the same ways, who have the same issues as, say, you as a young adult cancer patient, survivor, caregiver. And it's just showing you one of the ways in which they dealt with it, right? So I think the raw, honest, and authentic stories sometimes help you a lot more than any advice you get. Because not everyone wants to thrive after cancer. Not everyone, this productivity obsession, which is a very capitalistic American way of living, has seeped into even our society. And I don't think it's necessarily the most healthiest way of living. Because life is not about how much money you have, how much fame you have, how much success you have, how big your house is, how big your car is, how expensive your watch is. It's about the kind of relationships you've built and the amount of goodwill you have collected and the kind of impact you've made in society and people's lives, which doesn't require any money, success, influence, or property of any kind. So that's one of the lessons that I learned. And that's what I focus on. That even right now, if I have limited capacity to work, I certainly can't work a 14-hour job. I probably can't even do a very hectic 8-hour job. Maybe I'll be able to do in the future once I've recuperated completely. But right now, I can't. And I don't want to either. But I can do work nonetheless. I can keep working. I can keep doing projects. Even before coming to Harvard, I was working with the government of Telangana in helping them set up their EV skilling centers across the state. It is possible for me to continue working, just not in the way it was being done earlier. So I have a lot more focus on my health now than earlier.
I would have ended with three life lessons. You already very organically gave us one beautiful life lesson. Any other life lessons you think that you would like to leave us with, Sanjay?
I think I'll repeat some of the things I've mentioned throughout this episode. One, you're on borrowed time. Never forget that. So don't wait for a future to do things that you really want to do. Do them now. Don't leave them for some unforeseeable future. You may not have that. One. Number two, don't take your health lightly because if you treat your body like it's an abundant resource which will never need to be replenished, you're essentially treating it as trash, and that's going to backbite at some point of time. So treat your health as the priority number one in life. Number three, the value of your life will be measured not by the amount of money you've made, not by the fame, not by the influence, but by your relationships and the impact you've made in people's lives. It doesn't need to be a gigantic impact. It could be an impact on 10 people's lives, 3 people's lives. So focus on that. That's the most important thing. Those are the three that I can think of on the top of my mind.
So the impact you're talking about, I truly believe in. And it's truly an honor to have had you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. People like you come into our lives for a specific reason with a particular purpose, and you have found yours. While many of us are still groping to find ours, this uniqueness and individuality that you carry makes you extremely special. You are one of the most beautiful human beings I have met. Such a pleasure meeting you, Sanjay, and I'm sure everyone you talk to, you are inspiring and touching. God bless you, Sanjay.
Thank you so much, Rashmi.
Bye and take care. With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.